This is Drive with Josh Zepps on ABC Radio Sydney.
It's 2 years since the Uluru Statement from the Heart was published, in which a council of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders proposed changing the Australian Constitution to create a new body of Indigenous representatives, a voice, to advise Parliament on issues that affect their community. And this week is National Reconciliation Week. To help us think about what that means in 2019, Stan Grant is here, ABC's Global Affairs and Indigenous Affairs analyst. Stan, thanks for being
here. G'day, Josh. How are you?
Wonderful. You've got a piece in the Sydney Morning Herald this morning in which you say that some Indigenous friends of yours are despondent, frankly, about the next 3 years of a Conservative Scott Morrison government, but that you're not. Why not?
Look, and the despondency is easy to understand, because if there's one thing we know, is we know where we stand, because this is the government that Scott Morrison was a part of, albeit he wasn't leading at the time. This is the government that said no. They rejected the Uluru Statement. So that's your starting point, okay? You're starting from a position where a government has already said no. Why I am optimistic about this is because I think in Scott Morrison there is someone that you can talk to about these issues where he may get a grasp of what you're actually trying to achieve. And by this I mean the Uluru Statement from the Heart in and of itself is a very conservative document. What more conservative document can there be in something that says we can uphold and enhance the Constitution of Australia? That this is planted right at the sweet spot of Australian liberal democracy. And I think that could talk to someone like Scott Morrison in a way that perhaps it didn't talk to before. The other thing, Josh, is that Scott Morrison has a command of the party after his remarkable win that Malcolm Turnbull did not enjoy, because he was fighting the right flank of his party throughout his prime ministership. And Labor has already said yes. They've already given this a tick. If you then get the Conservatives on side, well, you're a long way to winning a referendum. So I think there are some positives to take away, despite the fact that you're starting from a position where a government, the same government, has already said no.
Are you sort of saying that it takes a person on the side of politics that would normally oppose something to be the key that can unlock that, essentially, in the same sense perhaps that the Hawke government was ostensibly on the left but implemented all of these conservative economic reforms like floating the dollar and deregulating the economy and selling off the state bank and so on?
I think you've nailed it. You know, it's the Nixon to China moment. Remember, it took Richard Nixon to go to China at the height of the Cultural Revolution and sit down with Mao and forge a new relationship between the two implacable enemies.
Does Scott Morrison have the vision of a Richard Nixon?
Well, he has the opportunity of a Nixon. It's the conservative moment that Nixon was able to go there and re-energize and re-engage in the relationship with China. And you can draw a line from that to where China is today. For good or ill, that's a whole other conversation. But you can draw a line from that to the opening up of China and its re-emergence into the world. In the same way that it may take a conservative leader to see the potential of something like this and deliver on what Indigenous people have seen as the unfinished business. If we can accept for a moment, if you're playing a 95% strategy here, and you accept for a moment that 50% of it's locked in, if you're given that the progressives are already on side, and they've already said this, if you lock in the other, well, you're home. But we also know you can't win a referendum if you don't have a broad bipartisanship in our politics. Mm. Republicans will tell you that, right? So I think there is an opportunity, and I think it may be the right time for a conservative leader like Scott Morrison to embrace this idea. I'm not saying he will, I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying that he's giving signs already that he is open to this conversation.
And certainly one would imagine that it would be easier at a time when the coalition is in government, because in opposition, as you say, the referendum's not going to pass unless both sides of politics support it, and it's harder for an opposition party to support what their opponents are doing if they're in opposition than if they have the ability to feel like their fingerprints are all over it themselves.
You know what else, Josh? I think there's another opportunity here, and this may be counterintuitive to some people, but it's not to me. Next year is 2020, 250 years since Captain Cook's arrival. A moment that changed life on this continent forever and that led to the nation that we have today. Now, this is Scott Morrison's electorate. It is Cook. He is going to embrace, and he's already embraced, the commemoration of that 250 years. There is, I think, around $30 million that's been earmarked for various commemorations. And there's going to be a new statue around Botany Bay, and there's going to be this circumnavigation of Australia, although the Endeavour never did that, but it's going to be part of that commemoration. Here's where the opportunity lies. Australia today, and Aboriginal people and myself, we feel the weight of that history very heavily. But Australia in 2020, as we're about to be, is not Australia of 1770. It's not Australia of 1970. Is there an opportunity here to join these stories, to write a new contract for Australia in a sense that says, yes, that was a moment that changed us forever. Yes, Indigenous people deal with the legacy of that. But here's how Australia has changed. We had the 67 referendum, which was about political inclusion and bringing Indigenous people more firmly into mainstream body politic of Australia. So that was about our law. That was about our fairness fundamentally. We also had the Mabo decision, which led to native title. The highest court in the land saying that terra nullius, the basis on which this land was claimed for the Crown, was a fiction, and that Aboriginal people's sovereignty and title continues. And that can be absorbed within our legal system. You have fairness in 67. You have law with the Mabo decision in 92. In 2007, you have the apology to the stolen generations. That's the healing of history. Fairness, law, healing of history. Now we have a political opportunity here to finish the unfinished business. It may be that there's a synthesis here. There's a synergy between what's happening in 2020, the unfinished business, and the ability to finish that. It may be an opportunity.
What about the claim, the Conservative claim, that the unfinished business is best thought of as a set of interlocking kind of social needs? So health needs, welfare needs, practical on-the-ground needs, criminal justice reform needs, but that the idea of creating an Indigenous body, this separate body, is a clumsy and bureaucratic and, frankly, undemocratic response to the problem.
It goes to the heart of the question, that, because that's, again, it may appear to be counterintuitive to the idea of what a liberal democracy is, which is premised on the idea of individual rights rather than group rights. And you're right, there is a social contract to provide the things that Australians all have a right to in this country. Opportunity, to overcome disadvantage, the potential to aspire, to achieve your dreams. That is the social contract we have in Australia. And Aboriginal people who've been locked out of that and still disadvantaged in that should have access to all that social contract implies. But there is another layer here, and I think this is the opportunity to create a bigger idea of Australia and to embrace liberal democracy in a way that speaks to the rights of Indigenous people. Aboriginal people have rights inherent in Australia that other Australians don't enjoy. One of them, of course, being native title. Now, from native title, there is a cascade of issues that emerge from that. Land management, land use, mining royalties, water rights, access arrangements. All of these things require negotiation with a range of bodies, state and local governments, shareholders, pastoralists, mining groups, a whole lot of groups where you need to negotiate that. Now, those rights need representation that Aboriginal people don't have. The other part of that, Josh, is that the Parliament has the right to make laws for Aboriginal people as distinct people, and it makes laws for Indigenous people in a way that it doesn't make laws specifically for any other group of Australians. So when you have a group of Australians for whom the Parliament can make special laws, when you have rights inherent that emerge from something like native title, you need a mechanism to give representation and voice to those aspirations and allow for better outcomes. And that's where our constitution is a rule book. It's a very utilitarian thing. It's not a constitution written about rights or poetry. It is very functional. This is a functional solution to what has been a political roadblock.
Let's talk about identity in Australia, because it's been a sort of a subtext to the election, and it's an overt. What's the opposite of a subtext? It's just text in National Reconciliation Week. It's just text. And you and I were speaking yesterday on Weekend Breakfast, the TV show that I co-anchor, about the challenge for you straddling two identities, really, and how eloquently you speak and write about this challenge, about why do you have to pit your black ancestors against your white ancestors? Why is there this battle that can never end? Why do you have to pick between ship and shore? Mm. Where does that lie in 21st century Australia, and how can Indigenous Australians help white Australians rethink their own identity?
A couple of things. I don't like identity essentialism. I don't like the idea of oppositional identities, and I think that there are real problems, deep problems that we see in our world where identity is framed around resistance and opposition, particularly based around historical grievance. I think you can draw a line between the conflicts of our age and this identity that's rooted in blood, rooted in grievance and historical wound that people essentialize themselves around, that this is who I am and this is all I will be. And it doesn't speak to the reality of our lives, Josh, because we intersect in so many different ways. I am black, I am white, I am Australian, I've lived abroad, you know, which football team I follow, which suburb I live in, who I'm married to, all of these things, all of our interlocking relationships give us layers to our identity. So I have a layered identity. I think in a very healthy way. Wiradjuri, Gummeroi, Dharawal, Irish, Australian, in various contexts, those various aspects of my identity may have more priority. But they are all me, and I'm not reduced to one particular thing. Here's the problem when identity intersects with politics, and I think there is a problem for the Labor Party emerging from this. When your politics is tied to your identity, you are locked into an unchanging position, because to change your politics, to change your mind, to change your policies requires you to disavow an identity. And I think progressive politics around the world has been captured by identity groups with various agendas and the inability to think beyond that to a bigger idea of a citizenship, a bigger idea of a civic we rather than our various constituent groups. And for Aboriginal people, this is particularly problematic when our identities have been politicised, we've been defined and redefined, we've been excluded. Overcoming that legacy and joining that idea of a civic we with a 21st century Australia requires innovation, forward thinking, and the type of political acumen that is required to deliver on the promise of something like the Uluru Statement from the Heart. But it is essential to answering the problem of our age, which is increasing tribalism, arch-nationalism, populism, sectarianism, which tears at the fabric of our body politic. That's the big problem of our age.
It's somewhat ironic, isn't it, that as the world has gotten more globalised and we've become more interconnected, and there was this assumption maybe at the end of the 20th century that we were all going to become more universalist, I guess, in our outlook. What's actually happened is a certain resurgence of parochialism, nationalism, tribalism, and identitarianism. Mm. And that some identities, it strikes me, are more okay to treat as reductionist than others. So I'm a mutt as well as, you know, as much as anybody else. You know, I've got Polish, Irish, English, French, New Zealand. It goes all the way back. But there are a couple of identities. One is being half Jewish, right, and the other is being gay.
Yes,
that are hair triggers, where I'm actually encouraged to think much more.
And you have to join the tribe.
And I have to be part of the tribe.
And if you go against the tribe, you're expelled from the tribe.
If I have something positive to say about the Palestinian plight, then I'm a self-hating Jew. If I have something positive to say about Israel Folau, then I'm a self-hating gay person.
Or not even something positive. You may just allow the fact that Israel Folau has a right to speak.
Right.
And
yes,
a faith.
Because it's a pluralistic country.
Yeah.
So what do you make of the different ways in which some identities are regarded as coming along with a whole lot of baggage that others don't carry?
You know, it's really, there's so much in that question.
And you've got 4 minutes to answer.
I know,
exactly.
Let's go. And it does go to the question of our age. I think you touched on something right off the bat there. The promise of liberalism is universalism. It is freed from our ethnic, racial, cultural identities. It is freed, in fact, from our histories. At its worst, that can be an erasure or an amnesia. But at its best, it's a liberating idea. The promise of liberalism was to deliver us a universalism and a cosmopolitanism. That sometimes liberalism can be too successful. Maybe it ignores the fact that we are deeply, at another level, deeply tribal people with a desire to belong. And I think as liberal democracies have become more pluralistic and more diverse, you have contending groups making ethical claims on the state that end up pitting themselves against each other, and liberal democracy struggles to deal with that level of diversity. And then in any political antagonistic situation, various groups are going to use whatever means are at their disposal. So if you have suffered a history of oppression, exclusion, neglect, Indigenous people, colonisation and segregation, then that becomes part of your armoury. So part of your claim on the state is to say, look how bad I was treated. There is something essential about me that needs to be recognised. The Greeks say thymos, this desire to be seen as a human being, to be recognised. This is the primary part of my identity, and this is the basis on which I make an ethical claim on the state. We saw that with the marriage equality vote. Here are a group of people, by virtue of sexuality, who are excluded, are denied rights that others enjoy. Now, they bring that claim to the state based on that exclusion and segregation and denial. When people form around those groups, it is then very easy to harden those groups. And that rather than see the capacity to build coalitions with others, to see beyond what is essential to you, you harden into that tribalism, that becomes your voice, that becomes the basis of your political ethical claim, and you then end up in a situation, in a very illiberal situation, where you cannot form those bigger coalitions with other people in your own society. It is a perfectly understandable response and consequence of liberal democracy, but it carries within it the seed of the destruction or the winding back of the strengths of that liberal democracy.
So one way to avoid such an outcome of us being pitted against each other in tribalised groups will be presumably to find a way to, for us all to cohere under the umbrella of a larger aspiration, right? Because as each minority asserts its rights and its individual identity, you get a reaction to that, a reactionary reaction to that, where white middle Australia, for in this case, might push back and say, actually, you know what? No. I like my way of doing things as well. All this new fancy rights for your gays and your Aborigines can just take a back seat for a moment. Thank you very much.
I've got a mortgage to pay.
I've got a mortgage to pay.
Kids to educate.
That's right, yes. Yeah. I've got
a job in a mine, and that may mean that your energy policy can just back off for a while.
Right, yeah. So as we all hunker down into this, into these crouches, shooting arrows across the rampart at each other in a kind of war of attrition, that can either go in the direction of being a sort of a cultural cold civil war or could foster some more unity, how do you go towards the latter? What's the umbrella?
You know, if I pull back on that, I think you can start to see where the connections are here. I think post-Cold War and the success or the rise of neoliberalism, which essentially marketed, you know, elevated commerce above culture, elevated the market above all, it also had another effect in that it removed politics and antagonism from our democracies. Democracies became about the third way, triangulation, Clinton and Blair. We will take aspects of neoliberal market economy, we will grow the economic pie, and we will then turn politics into questions of ethics or morality. But the deep political antagonisms that sit at the heart of liberal democracy were banished to the fringes. And that worked for a long time, Josh, until we hit the global financial crisis, the attack on the World Trade Center. It really shook the foundations of liberal democracy globally. We're locked into an unending war against terrorism that has morphed into various theatres around the world. We're also locked into this sense that our financial system, our economy has somehow failed us. There's been increased inequality. It has widened the gap between people. It has led to a resentment from those who feel left out against those they perceive as the elites. And antagonism is back in our politics. Here's the challenge, I think. The right, broadly, can speak very effectively to these ideas. The right is comfortable with a language and a narrative around nationalism that speaks to faith and community and appeals to a sense that people have been left out. That's very comfortable for them. I think the progressives have found it very difficult without demonising or dismissing or being condescending to the very people they seek to lead. So you end up with a Hillary Clinton deplorables comment. You end up with this arrogance that says that people who voted against Brexit are somehow backwards. You end up with this idea that this was an illegitimate election in Australia because Labor was supposed to win. And who are all these people voting to the Adani mine and to hold on to their jobs? Can't they see what's happening to the community? You start lecturing people. And here is the challenge. particularly for progressive politics. Can you hold that antagonism in our politics in place and speak across the divide without retreating into your own tribes and your own collection of various identity groups? If that's the way you're going to do, if that's going to be the competition from now on, A, it's not going to be too good for our democracy, but B, I think the evidence right now may be that the so-called conservatives or the right will actually win. They won in America with Trump. They won in Brexit. There's a resurgence of right politics across Europe. Viktor Orban in Hungary has increased his majority. If that's the politics you're going to play, you're going to have results like we saw on the weekend. So there's got to be out of this emerging a capacity to speak across the divide, to hold the antagonism that is essential to politics without banishing it, and to move beyond that tribalism. I don't know that any leader speaks to that right now. It is a battle of culture. It is a battle of politics. It is a battle of our tribes, and it isn't necessarily healthy for us. We got a better shot in Australia, though, I think, than most others do. I really do.
Stan Grant, always a pleasure to talk to you. Happy National Reconciliation
Great, mate.
Week.
Thank you.
That's Stan Grant, the ABC's Global Affairs and Indigenous Affairs Analyst.
Keep up to date with ABC Radio.
Tweet us on Twitter.
Like us on Facebook.
And follow us on Instagram.
Catch the latest from ABC Radio.
Anywhere, anytime.